Hey listeners, if you haven't already, you should check out the Eurasia Group Foundation's podcast, None of the Above, which offers new ideas and answers to America's most pressing foreign policy questions. Find None of the Above wherever you get your podcasts.
From Foreign Policy, I'm Sarah Wildman, and this is First Person. This week, the return of the Queen of Shoes. Imelda Marcos, the wife of ousted Philippine dictator Ferdinand Marcos, remains a fixture in global collective memory as the Marie Antoinette of shoes. She and her husband amassed huge wealth during a 21-year reign in the Philippines. They were ousted in a popular revolution in 1986. Imelda left behind a collection of thousands of luxury shoes.
Beneath the bedroom, her wardrobe, a veritable department store of shoes and clothing. Bought in bulk, 2,200 shoes, often several colors, same design. Friends say they were only spares.
But while Ferdinand Marcos died in 1989, Imelda had a second act. She returned from exile in 1991 and was elected four times to the Philippine House of Representatives. She also championed the rise of her son to higher office.
Senator Ferdinand Bongbong Marcos Jr., only son of the late President Ferdinand Marcos, is one of those perceived to be eyeing to succeed President Noynoy Aquino, the son of his father's longtime political rivals, Ninoy and Cory Aquino.
This week on First Person, we hear from photographer and filmmaker Lauren Greenfield. Her documentary, The Kingmaker, traces the long life of Imelda Marcos and touches on her connection to Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte. Greenfield's previous films include The Queen of Versailles and Generation Wealth. I want to actually start by asking what led you to the idea of looking at Imelda Marcos.
Well, so in my photography and filmmaking, I've been working on the subject of wealth for a long time. My last book and show and movie was called Generation Wealth, which brought together 25 years of looking at materialism and consumerism and the 1% and inequality and kind of the effect of the 1% on everybody else. This was the first time I've looked at politics and power, but I came to Imelda Marcos because she had been a kind of iconic reference in my work on wealth, but didn't know she was alive and back in the Philippines as a congresswoman until I read this article in Bloomberg by this journalist, William Meller, which was about this animal island that she created. And this was kind of the most ultimate and egregious extravagance.
How did Imelda Marcos decide she wanted to have sort of her own personal safari, zoo, whatever it was? And how did she go about it?
She went to Kenya with President Marcos for a conference, and she saw these African animals, and she said, I would like to have them for the Philippines. And in the film, she says there were no people on this island that they selected, except a few that she could tell what to do. Well, actually, there were 254 indigenous families that got displaced. They had a kind of ship, Noah's Ark type ship, where they put these zebras and giraffes and other exotic animals on, and they shipped them over to the Philippines. And it was a very extravagant plan with veterinarians and caretakers. But once the Marcoses went into exile, the animals lost their funding and their patrons. And so a man who was young bureaucrat at the time, Froilan Sariego, kind of single-handedly cares for these animals with great love, but little resources or training. There wasn't really a long-term plan. And so there have now been four generations of inbreeding because there's no blood. Mm-hmm. So in a way, the animals are doomed genetically. And that became a metaphor for political dynasty and the ill effects of political dynasty. It was really just the starting point, but for me, it was symbolic of the kind of recklessness of wealth and power. But what ended up happening is I thought it was going to be a story about history, and it ended up rushing into the present with a contemporary political story about money and power. And as Imelda ran her son Bongbong for the vice presidency, and it became a comeback story.
How did you get her to sit down for interviews?
She agreed to the first interview pretty quickly. The journalist who had written this Bloomberg article collaborated with me and he introduced me to her. And I think at the time when we began in 2014, I think she missed the attention of being on the world stage. I think she liked the interaction with journalists and foreign journalists. At the time, President Aquino was in power, Noynoy Aquino, the opposition. And so the Marcos were kind of sidelined, even though she was a congresswoman at that point, but they were not, you know, the people in power. And I think the stakes were lower. Then as we progressed, they started getting momentum in the election. And I think in a way, the election opened up more access because it became a comeback story.
It's interesting how you weave imagery throughout this film. And I think the sense of opulence and the kind of almost like Louis XIV's sense of a gilded life. Describe for us what it felt like walking into her space and seeing her in her gowns.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of fell in love with the aesthetic and playing with that. It very much resonated for me in terms of the work that I did in Generation Wealth and the kind of aspiration to royalty and what I've heard coined dictator chic, the kind of aesthetics of opulence. Imelda's somebody who loved being able to hobnob with people like Prince Charles and the Shah of Iran. And her space was so ornate and gilded, but also from another time. I was really interested in the way it was kind of frozen in time. She talked about the past. She was surrounded by the relics of the past, the photographs of her with the foreign leaders, the priceless paintings that she acquired during their dictatorship. And in her interviews, they're very much adorned by all of her things. And you see servants coming in and attending to her and hair and makeup coming in. What happened is, as I realized that she was a very unreliable narrator, I realized I needed to bring in truth tellers, credible storytellers, eyewitnesses who could check her untruths. And those interviews are very different aesthetically. They're very simple. Often people are not wearing makeup and the backgrounds are modest homes or almost look like safe houses. And so there was that marked contrast between the opulence of Imelda's world. I think it also felt like a world in decay, a world of fiction and myth-making. There's a lot of painted portraits that they've commissioned in the beginning of the film. We see in one of the palaces a giant portrait of Imelda as a kind of mermaid with Ferdinand Marcos, the president, as a kind of merman. And then she's holding all the children, the political dynasty in a shell in her hand.
Most of the world knows her because of those shoes, that kind of iconic image of seeing all those rows and rows and rows of shoes. But tell me about her early life. How did she become Imelda Marcos?
I tell her backstory because I don't think she was always the Imelda, the kingmaker, the kind of very ambitious, power-hungry matriarch that we see in the film. I think she begins as an innocent girl from the province who is in the poor part of a rich family and in a way maybe has those ambitions because she sees other members of her family living differently. She loses her mother at a young age and that really marks her. And she kind of throws herself in the arms of Marcos when she meets him through being a beauty pageant queen. And she says he proposed to her in the first 20 minutes and they married in 11 days. She's honest about the fact that she's looking for love, and she even says looking for a mother. And I think that really shapes her. Marcos ends up having affairs that kind of hurts her deeply, and I think it begins her insatiable thirst for things and power, which I think is also looking for the love of the people. I think she just loves and has a kind of insatiable need for the love of the people.
The rule of Ferdinand Marcos, her husband and the president of the Philippines, began in 1965 and continued for two decades. She plays an incredibly significant role. Talk to us a little bit about that role.
Yeah, I mean, they called it the conjugal dictatorship. She is a kind of force to be reckoned with. Her son, Bong Bong, who runs for vice presidency in the film, says she's the best politician in the family, even better, presumably, than her husband, Ferdinand, who was the president. He used her as a kind of diplomat on the world stage. She was beautiful. She was charming. In the film, it's said that he also liked her leaving so he could have his affairs and also was afraid there would be a coup, so he didn't like to leave. But she went around the world and met with Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein and Chairman Mao. She says people think they're monsters, but they're really her dear friends, and they were so generous and kind. She said she didn't like to read books about the leaders she was meeting. She was just very intuitive and kind of personable in her meetings with people, which in a way relates my own view of her, because in the film we see that in person she can be charismatic and kind, and yet she and her husband were responsible for terrible atrocities, both corruption, taking $5 to $10 billion from the country, and also human rights abuses.
You speak to a number of people, and you mentioned them earlier as the truth tellers, those who were tortured during the regime. Can you pick one of those stories and tell it to us?
Yeah. May Rodriguez tells a very moving story about being a young woman who is part of the resistance and getting arrested during martial law and getting tortured. And she tells the kind of heart-rending story of being raped and sexually abused and her captors looking to see if she has letters, suspecting her of having letters in her private parts. She had never told that story before. One of the big themes of the film is about how if history is not taught and if we don't remember history, people forget it. May says that one of the mistakes the activists made was not insisting that martial law be taught in the schools.
And during that time, what did it exactly mean, martial law? I mean, how did it play out?
The press was shut down. Congress was shut. The judiciary's power was taken away. There was a curfew. And the opposition was jailed. And the resistance was incarcerated. There was torture. And there were over 3,000 people killed.
The Marcoses, Ferdinand and Imelda, amass an enormous amount of wealth, billions of dollars. What was their lifestyle like?
It was incredibly extravagant. Although I think that Andy Bautista, who was head of the PCGG, who went after the ill-gotten wealth, says that...
Tell us what the PCGG...
The PCGG was the commission formed in 1986 to recuperate the ill-gotten wealth. Mm-hmm. And they spent years kind of going after it, but did not get a lot of it. And he says that he thinks the shoes are a distraction, that people focused on the shoes, but those were just child's play compared to the jewelry and the paintings and the money in what Imelda says in the film is more than 170 banks. They had palaces all around the country, huge stores of jewelry. The head of Christie's said rivaling Queen Elizabeth and Elizabeth Taylor. Yeah. There's still over 170 paintings missing. And these paintings, to give you an example of how they've appreciated, the Monet painting featured in the film, the Marcus has bought for under $1 million and it sold for $40 million.
And in the film, you actually show that she sort of seems to be playing a sort of shell game with her painting. She moves them. And so you see, you interview her with a Picasso behind her and their images of her with these extremely iconic paintings. And then all of a sudden they're gone.
It was incredible. Again, what I thought was going to be a story about the past comes rushing into the present. I interviewed Andy Bautista, head of the PCGG, about the ill-gotten wealth, which was taken before 1986. But while in this period where we were filming, beginning in 2014, the PCGG did a raid on all of their mansions and apartments looking for some of these paintings. They had to get a search warrant for the raid. And so Andy says that Imelda Marcos kept them waiting first in the lobby for 2 hours. And by the time they got up to the apartment, all of the paintings were gone that you see in her first interview. And they've been replaced with photographs of the Marcoses. But when they asked to go into her master bedroom. They said that was off limits.
If you're looking for a new podcast, check out None of the Above from the Eurasia Group Foundation. The show offers new ideas about the future of America's role in the world. The host, Mark Hanna, sits down with leading global thinkers, journalists, activists, and historians to discuss new ideas for American foreign policy. The Eurasia Group Foundation is a nonprofit founded by Ian Bremmer and dedicated to helping people understand how geopolitics affects their lives. Look for None of the Above, a fantastic new foreign policy podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
So at the end of the Ferdinand Marcos regime, a mass movement arises called the People's Power Revolution. How did those activists help to topple the Marcos regime?
So in 1983, the main opposition leader, Benigno Aquino, who had been jailed since the beginning of martial law in 1972, they had let him go to the United States for health matters. He decided to come back and try to make a change because the dictatorship had become so corrupt. He was assassinated on the tarmac, which is covered in the film, and many people think Imelda and the general at the time, General Vare, were responsible. The president, Ferdinand Marcos, was very ill at the time.
And in theory, Imelda was actually acting in his stead.
Yes, she was very, very powerful, and she and the general were making a lot of decisions.
Do you think she was behind the assassination?
Yes, I do. I mean, that's what Beth de Romelu says, and she was married to the general who was Ferdinand Marcos' right hand. Mm-hmm. President Noynoy Aquino, the son of the slain leader, says that she cautioned his dad not to come back, so she must have known what would happen when he did come back. People don't think that the gunman who was on the tarmac of the airport would have been able to get that close without the approval of kind of the highest in the military and government. But it's never been proven. That assassination is really what begins the people power and people just not being willing to take it anymore. And so people end up taking to the streets in a peaceful revolution. But once the United States was very much backing the Marcos, and the United States had military bases in the Philippines that were very important strategically. But once the assassination happened and people really started coming out in the streets, the United States pushed for elections, and Marcos ended up having a snap election in which he loses to Cory Aquino but says he won and says it was fraud. And so they were both winners declared. But at that point, the United States said he had to go and sent a helicopter for him, brought him to Hawaii. And Imelda in the film says they didn't flee. They were kidnapped. They were kidnapped by the United States. They tried to take crates and crates of valuables out of the country, cash and jewelry, and a lot of these things were confiscated at U.S. Customs in Hawaii.
And what happened to it?
Well, some of it has been the subject of many court cases, but there have been kind of few consequences for the Marcoses. $4 billion out of the suspected $5 to $10 billion that they stole was recovered by the government over the years. And
when you say they stole it, what do you mean exactly?
Well, they had money in foreign accounts. They kind of pioneered.
But what was the money from? That's what I mean.
A lot of the money was from USAID, mm-hmm. but also from the resources of the country. They took, martial law was very convenient in terms of being a way to stay in power, but also skim from all of the businesses. So they took over most of the businesses in the country, which were then run by their cronies. And apparently Ferdinand Marcos had a kind of ledger in his office which was found after they left. But they took money from all of the businesses in the country. In fact, at one point, Imelda did an interview for press and said something about how all of the businesses were theirs, sugar, communications, everything.
In American, the consciousness of Americans and most of us, the story of Imelda Marcos kind of ends there. What did she do afterwards, though? Her story doesn't end.
And that was really the starting point for the film, is the fact that people just knew about the shoes. They just knew. And she wasn't even completely held accountable. When the U.S. had a big case against her in U.S. versus Marcos, the U.S. lost the case. And part of it was that Ferdinand Marcos died during the case. And I think the jury didn't know whether they could hold the First Lady accountable for how much she actually knew about what was going on, although the evidence points to her being a very, very strong figure in the administration and their decisions. But she is in the U.S. for a while, goes through this case, and then returns to the Philippines in 1991. Now, Cory Aquino, the new president, the wife of the slain leader, who wins in people power, allows Imelda Marcos to come back. Beth De Romulo in the film, her friend who was married to the general, says the Filipinos are very forgiving people. So they let her come back, but they did not let her bring the body back for a little while.
The body of Ferdinand Marcos.
The body of Ferdinand Marcos, which ends up coming back and not getting buried in the Hero Cemetery as Imelda wants, but kind of put on ice in the north, like Stalin or Mao, and in a mausoleum for 30 years. And I don't know if I want to be a spoiler, but that's kind of one of the big things that happens at the end of the film is Imelda gets her dream of burying Marcos in the Hero Cemetery. But I should say, so she comes back and becomes a congresswoman.
Yeah.
Her son eventually becomes a senator. Mm-hmm. Her daughter becomes a governor. And little by little, her nephews become mayors and congressmen. Little by little, they start to come back to power.
Is there pushback from those who remember military rule?
No, not really. And I think, you know, they start in their bailiwicks in the north and the south. And it's almost like they had a plan to come back little by little, and people kind of let them do things because they didn't really see the big picture. Like, okay, they have power in the north, where Ferdinand Marcos was from, in the south, where Imelda's from, not really thinking that this could be on the national stage again. Mm-hmm. But in the film, Bong Bong runs for vice presidency, which can be a backdoor to the presidency in the Philippines. And their eye on the return to Malacañang Palace and the top job becomes clear.
And do you feel that she's the political operative behind the rise of her children and her nephews?
She's a very powerful matriarch. And her son, Bong Bong, admits that he doesn't have the political skills of his mother. And his own son says dad didn't really want to be a politician. He wanted to be a mathematician, but actually says that his grandfather, Ferdinand Marcos, said, go into politics for the money. It's better than math. But you see that he's, in a way, an accidental politician. The movie is also about political dynasty and the kind of ill effects from political dynasty. But in their family, it's the family business. And the Philippines is a place where there are kind of dynastic political families.
Is there scrutiny on all that wealth and the continuation? I mean, how much she continues to hold?
There is scrutiny, but there are not always consequences. So the opposition certainly talked about the ill-gotten wealth. The woman who becomes the vice president, Lenny Robredo, asked Bong Bong Marcos about the ill-gotten wealth at the debates. There have been hundreds of cases in the Philippines trying to recuperate the ill-gotten wealth, and yet the Marcoses have been able to hold on to much of the wealth. One of the things that Andy Bautista predicts is that under Duterte, who we discover is aligned with the Marcoses, many of the cases will be dropped, that Duterte is not interested in keeping up the power of the PCGG. And there is a desire to have a solicitor general take it over who was actually involved in Bongbong Marcos' campaign. And in the last several months, three of the big cases have been dismissed.
Draw for us a little bit clearer the line between Rodrigo Duterte and the Marcos family.
That was a kind of breaking news revelation that happened towards the end of my time filming there. Duterte was elected in 2016, and he had spoken during his campaign of his admiration for the dictator Ferdinand Marcos and kind of his admiration of him as a strong man. Mm. But it wasn't clear that there was an alliance until he was in a press conference and says, when nobody would fund my campaign, Aimee Marcos gave me money. And Aimee is in the audience and looks kind of surprised at what seems to be a spontaneous revelation, which she and Bong Bong then deny.
She's one of the daughters.
And she's the daughter of Imelda Marcos. There seems to be a quid pro quo because shortly after that, Imelda Marcos gets her longtime dream of Ferdinand Marcos' body being buried in the Hero Cemetery. This is something that the activists fought vehemently against and that every president since 1986 did not allow because of the stolen money, but also because of martial law and the thousands and thousands of people that were incarcerated, tortured, killed during martial law. He was not considered a hero. And so for him to be buried in their version of Arlington was something that was unimaginable before.
You obviously said several times that the sort of idea of being doomed to repeat history, and here the Philippines now has a leader who is another strongman. How do you see that as mirroring or parallel to the Marcoses?
It was such a shock when Duterte won and then what he proceeded to do after winning. I think to the people like May and Etta, these activists, to have another strongman who also began extrajudicial killings. May says there have been up to 30,000 extrajudicial killings in the name of a so-called drug war, but without any due process. He has created a climate of fear, which is similar to martial law. And so it's almost like post-traumatic stress for the activists who fought martial law. There's so many things under Duterte that are similar, from his attacks on the media to starting to control Congress and the judiciary. And
you imply in the film that actually he's paving the way for Bong Bong to step in.
He hasn't hidden the fact that he would prefer that Bong Bong become vice president. Bong Bong lost by a very small margin and then created an electoral protest, eerily similar of what his father did in 1986 when he lost the election and then claimed to have won. And it's been with the Supreme Court for 2 years, and Duterte has often said that he would much prefer Bong Bong Marcos be in that position.
The resurgence of Imelda Marcos, or maybe that she never went away, it seems indicative of the political moment we're in around the world with the surge of autocrats and the rise of a new authoritarianism. And I know this film is about one person specifically, but what do you think it says more broadly about the time we're in?
Yeah, I mean, for me, the film really spoke to the fragility of democracy and how in the space of one election, there was so much that was lost in terms of the democracy that they created after 1986, and also the appeal of the strongman. I mean, one of the things that happened from the money that was stolen by the Marcoses is it kind of helped create persistent poverty, or at least elongate the persistent poverty in a way that made people kind of desperate for somebody who promised change and quick change, which Duterte did. I think it also speaks to the rewriting of history and how if people don't remember history, it repeats itself. And the combination of not teaching martial law rigorously in the schools with a disinformation campaign fueled by social media was a toxic brew in terms of young people, especially people who were too young to remember before 1986, believing the propaganda of the Marcoses.
You said at the very beginning that you call her an unreliable narrator, and she has this amazing moment in the film where she says, truth isn't real, perception is real. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Well, that's another thing that I think so brilliantly describes our time and her incredible insight into the kind of media landscape and image landscape. She says perception is real, the truth is not. It also speaks to their ability to rewrite history. And in the film, you see her very conscious of image and the way she's kind of presenting to camera, whether it's her hair and makeup coming in or moving a gold sheep that's in the foreground of the frame. In the film, what you discover little by little is that while she's an incredibly charismatic storyteller, many of the stories have no corroboration in any historical accounts or first-person testimonials. And so I realized as a filmmaker, I needed to go out of the Marcos bubble and bring in these truth-tellers like May Rodriguez, a survivor of torture during martial law, to counter Imelda Marcos' claim, for example, that martial law was the best time of Marcos. So one of the ways I realized in the beginning that her stories were not true was with the Animal Island. She said that there were no animals left, that when she came back, she went back there and there were no animals left. Well, there are as many animals as there were in the beginning, more than 100. And I had the chance to see and film the animals, and also their caretaker, Froilan Sarajevo, says that Mrs. Marcos never went back.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Lauren Greenfield, director of the film The Kingmaker. First Person is produced by me, Sarah Wildman, along with help from Dan Haverty. Our editor is Rob Sachs, and our executive editor for news and podcasts is Dan Efron. If you liked this episode, hit subscribe on your podcast app. Tell your friends, tweet about it, then come back next week. We'll be back with a new episode.
Thank you.